I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I am really thankful you're here, Conda, and on behalf of the network, Be Here Now Network, it's a big welcome to you and Mirabai. And I want to say that above all, Conda Mason is going to be doing a podcast. And it will be starting very soon. Where are we? In the middle of June? Well, we're hoping to get it going, what, in a couple of weeks, Conda, maybe? Yeah. So that's very exciting. And Conda knows a host of people that she'll be talking with and hanging out with. So what's it going to be called?
It's called the Brown Rice Hour.
Ah.
And it's a conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit.
Mm.
Those are the conversations that I'm having right now. And so I was like, as long as I can, you know, stick with the conversations that I've been interested in, then I could do it. And you all said, do your thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, you know, it's the way it is for all of us, and certainly the way it is for me when I'm doing any of the podcasts that I've been doing. It's got to be something that I really feel interested in, and I feel it's going to, you know, educate myself as well as share back and forth, which is really what the podcasts are all about. So I gave a little bit of a contextualization of what we'd be doing and what we'd be talking about here, but I'm just looking around and going, okay, we're all feeling the combined weight of COVID, of racial injustice, of economic collapse in front of us. And how can we find the resilience to weather this storm? And, you know, we've been doing things from Love, Serve, Remember, putting together a weekly newsletter that has, each one of them has a core something from Ram Dass, who has been dealing with all of this kind of thing for a long, long time. And so the relevance of what he said back then is amazing how relevant it is for right now. So we've been doing that. And I think that one of the things that's happening for me is just the start of understanding. I have a little bit of a different background because I'm from Canada, which is it is different than growing up in the United States to some degree. But I am just, what's happening and what this is uncovering for me is looking, where's my shadows with all of this? By virtue of just even, you know, watching any of the events through social media or on television and seeing, you know, my own reactions and then looking back into my own experiences of any of the shadow that covers over the reality that we are so uncovered in right now. So I don't know, Khanda, just if you want to talk a little bit about the shadows that we relate with through the spiritual work that we do, the work through mindfulness and so on, and how that can be a great advantage in looking at how we see the fear from COVID, how we have felt about our interactions with Black community and our fear of the economic collapse. How do we look at all these shadows in a profitable way?
You know, shadows is an interesting frame. Underneath it all is a system that has been designed to do what it's doing. And one of the things that it's doing is keeping white people blind to the systemic nature of the existence of white supremacy and privilege. And it's designed, I believe that it's really designed to do that so that it continues to hold itself up if you can't see it. It's the most invisible, it's like this invisible ideology and frame that has the absolute most visible impact of privilege, right? Of access, of benefit. Something that's absolutely, it's interesting to me that, you know, most white people do not see the structure, and yet they live 100% from the benefit of this invisible shadow, I guess, right? And so one of the things that continues to happen is that we have these conversations on a person-to-person basis, which is necessary, you know, personal bigotry, personal racism. And yet, as long as we keep it on a personal level, it's like the big Oz behind who's pulling all the levers. And we're not seeing that, and yet we're in this dialogue, because then we're not doing anything about bringing down the system, which is what needs to happen. We need to dismantle. It needs to be dismantled. It is underneath all of it. And it goes back to, it leads into all of our crises, honestly, which is this crisis of human, the way I see it, this crisis of human, this hierarchy, this hierarchical crises and ideology and lens that we have, our worldview of whether it's the global north over the global south, or whether it's gender-based, right? Male and female and who's on top. Whether it is racial, what we're talking about right now, whether it's just our species. I mean, if we look at the coronavirus and we think about what we've done to the other mm-hmm. kingdoms and species, and how we have dominated this planet, that tree outside my window, we have dominated, this whole mentality is what is being pointed to. And that has created, I mean, it's the worldview, how we see the world is the world that we create, right? What we think is how we create it. And we have created this world of dominance, of hierarchy, of and the one that we're talking about and seeing in the streets right now is based on race, right? And which is a construct in the first place, which is something that even, you know, is a human construct, this whole concept of race. And yet the impact of it is so huge and so material that there's no doubt that we have to look at it, deal with it, and do everything we can to eradicate it. This ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous notion of white supremacy and superiority. And it is in the fabric of everything in every institution. It is a structural issue that has been built into it. When I think about the building, you know, we have never had an America that has lived up to the ideals that we talk about. You know, there has never been equality and equal. This has never happened at the same time as this country is being formed. You know, genocide of, you know, indigenous people and enslavement of African, and all of it has, and then the richness, the absolute, and the economy, all of it is all tied together. All of this is led to the economic engine of the greatest country on earth on the backs of African millions and millions of accumulated hours of free labor, of free labor that allowed this place to be what it is. And so folks who feel like they can't see the advantage and the structure that has been put in place really have to do a lot of homework, really need to go back and really learn history and understand that even if you are a white person that did not grow up with wealth, even so, there is a place of privilege and advantage that you have had when there have been so many policies in place to prevent Black folk from having land, from having any kind of wealth, the whole redlining that has happened in our past. There's so much that has happened that has structurally prevented Black people from achieving any kind of equality in this country. And so, you know, it's something that it's just so prevalent. It's like the air we breathe, it's the water we drink. You can't see it, you know? Yeah. And yet it has the biggest impact than anything that exists. And so I think that what my biggest issue is with our community, and I talk about our community, I mean, there's many different communities we are a part of. And when I think about the spiritual community, the spiritual progressive community that is attracted to the Be Here Now podcast and network, are this tendency of the spiritual bypass that says, you know, that goes to the we are one, mm-hmm. that goes to aren't we all one? And what you said earlier, I don't see race, you know, going to the universal and not looking at the relative and answering the issues of the relative world with a universal answer. And so that is really a perpetuation of racism. As a matter of fact, those who say, I don't see color, I feel I have more fear of than those that don't, than the racist that is out there with you know, brandishing rifles and Confederate flags. I know who you are. I know you, I see you, you're showing me yourself with the Confederate flags and all that you're doing. But those who don't have those kinds of outward displays, who are your best friend and your people next door and the people that you go to lunch with and your friends, who, you know, I don't see race. It's like, first of all, it's a lie. if you don't see me as a Black woman, then I don't know what you're looking at. Okay. So first it's a lie. And it's a lie that wants to somehow obliterate race to obliterate oppression. That if I don't see it, then the oppression doesn't exist. It's like, let me cover my eyes. If I don't see it, then it can't exist. And so you can't partner with me to dismantle the system because you can't even take it in and acknowledge it. And so those are the issues. I mean, I can go on and on, but those are the issues. And that's what I see. And that's what this community has to really is in the face right now to address.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mirabai, yeah, we, this community and this idea, actually, I didn't tell you, Mirabai, but Conda and I talked when we were thinking about setting this up. Mm-hmm. And I was so struck, Conda, by what you said, that white America, I mean, this is not your exact words, but close to it, are living behind the veil of not knowing and not wanting to know, the veil of privilege, you know. And this is what I meant by these shadows, that when you said that, I, you know, it pushed me inside myself to see what's going on in, you know, in the core of my being around not addressing this, around, you know, having some platitudes about my relationship with Black community. The privilege, you said, the privilege of not knowing is now over. And is it not, right? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter, you know, it's interesting, Raghu, because I was with one of my friends and teachers at Spirit Rock, who I adore, white woman teacher. And we were having dinner one night, it was about 5 years ago. And we were talking about the race stuff that happens everywhere. And she mentioned to me how we really don't see it. She was like, you know, she lives in Marin County. She's like, how's that like that white people really don't see it. Like, we don't know what's really going on. And I'm like, really, how is that possible? How is that really possible? And the truth is that if you don't see it, then would you change places with a Black person? Would you be treated like a Black person? Would you change places? Mm-hmm. And there's not a white person I know that would say yes to that. Mm-hmm. Would you trade places? So maybe if you say no, you wouldn't trade places, then you know something. And what you know is very deep. You know, and you don't want it, right? And so I really think that there's a cognitive dissonance that lives within the white American psyche, because you know that there's something here. And you don't want to know, and you live a life accepting it. You see, you live a life accepting something that you know is wrong for a whole group of people.
Yeah, yeah.
You live a life accepting it. Mm. And you don't want to accept it because you're a good person. And so you live this. I mean, I live that with when I think about energy, you know, whenever I do something, when I fly. Okay, I'm on planes. I used to be on planes a lot. Glad that's one benefit of COVID. When I fly, I'm constantly in this cognitive dissonance about, oh God, you know, I'm really someone who's really, you know, living a green life and green footprint as much as possible. And here I am doing all this flying. You know, how do I rationalize that? Mm. You know, I rationalize it and go, well, I got to do that. You know, these are the things. So I know it myself. In that regard, right? And so what are the things around this race thing? Oh, I hope you didn't hear that. That you can, when you think about it, there's a place, and that's where the shadow is, that's being, you're hiding.
Yeah.
Because you know that there's something, you have to know the history of this country. And yet you live a life that just puts the veil, there's the veil, and it's like, that veil has got to go.
Yeah, it's our little happy place. That veil is intact, and it's
because what would you do? What will you? I mean, what kind of person does it make you to know that you've allowed this? That you've allowed it. Does that then now make you a bad person? Nobody wants to be a bad person, right? We want to be. We're good people, and you are good people. You know, I'm sure you are good people, and there's that fear of. You know, it's like watching someone get abused next door. You know, you have next door neighbors where the husband is abusing the wife and you don't do anything about it. So, I mean, it's that kind of a situation that I think that white people are right now looking at because of the state that our country is in.
Yeah.
And there's this discomfort, a big discomfort. It's like the comfort zone is like coming to a close and you're in this discomfort zone.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Mirabai, you have a little bit of a different perspective, but certainly from me. You have been doing this work for a very long time. And I think it'd be a good idea for you to share a little bit about how you've gone through and how you started doing this work. And basically, it's not just outer work, but the inner work that you did to really come to an understanding in yourself. And uncovered all of these shadows.
Well, first, Khanda, that's framing it that way is so helpful. That you know, it's not being willing to see, bringing you know, a what do we say, a veil or whatever it is. You know, I once realized that if you're confronted by a brick wall or a veil. If you can't see what's on the other side, it doesn't really matter. So even if you only have a veil keeping you from the truth, if you're not seeing it, it doesn't matter. So we, and since we're addressing the quote, spiritual community, people who are, people have done a lot of Vipassana mindfulness practice or, listen to Ram Dass's teachings, which the essence of is be here now.
Yeah.
It's all about seeing what is, seeing the truth, seeing like allowing yourself to let go of prejudgments and concepts and just seeing what's in front of you. And so this, it, in some way, it's like, kind of amazing that there's been so little seeing on this subject before, but this is a, you know, this is a spiritual practice, seeing what's happening and responding to it out of wisdom and compassion. Anyhow, yeah, well, there's also that syndrome of, you know, how could you not see it? How could you not see that systems in this country are devised and sustained in a way that is unjust for Black people, and it does give privilege to white people. But so I was thinking back, I hadn't thought about this in years, but this week I've been thinking about a lot. But when I grew up in Manhattan and New Jersey and didn't have any Black friends till I was in college. I didn't have any friends. I had friends, I didn't have any Black friends. And I was in education and I did student teaching. It was in Pittsburgh. And I student taught in a local Pittsburgh high school. It was all Black. It was a technical high school. And this is what they were teaching them for a career, shoe repair. you know, that was not being taught in the white schools at the time. And I knew it too. And that, for me, that was just like, you know, a veil got ripped away in that moment. Shoe repair. So then years later, I was in graduate school, and I was in graduate school in 68 and 69 when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and the State University of New York, the legislature in New York passed a law that said that the state university had to represent the demographics of New York State. So I was at Buffalo. That was the, you know, the largest part of the system. And they had the next year's freshman class had to be, I guess New York State at the time was like maybe 14% African-American. So, but the whole 4 years now had to be brought up to that. So it meant that the freshman class was over half students of color, mainly African-American. And they didn't have they didn't put up enough money to recruit students from other places. So they were all from Buffalo. Buffalo had the worst schools. I mean, sorry if you're from Buffalo, but they had really bad schools at the time. And black students there were never, they were never educated to think that they would go to college. So they didn't have any preparation at all. And they brought all these students onto campus. And there were no systems, no plans, no support for them, like figuring out how to be in such a place and succeed. The point wasn't just to bring them there. The point was to help them succeed and graduate. I almost by chance, I became part of, well, not by chance. I had like three black students in my class the year before. So I was considered an expert. So we started a program to educate, to support and prepare and find like culturally appropriate material and so on for these students. The only black faculty member in the whole university was Archie Shepp, great musician.
Oh,
musician. So they, wow. You know, anyhow, this I've got to stop. But so then a number of my students lived in the projects. They didn't have any space in which to do any studying. So a number of them moved into my apartment. It was also the year that George Wallace ran for president. He came to Buffalo. There were drive-by white-on-black shootings. The younger brother of one of my students who was living with me then was shot and killed.
Well, what you're pointing to, Maribai, is just the structural and institutional level of, and I'm going to call it more than just racism. What we are dealing with right now, which is another layer, is anti-black. It's anti-black.
Yeah.
And anti-blackness is a very specific racism that has its roots in chattel slavery, that has its roots in the dehumanization of black people, the attempt of dehumanization of black people, and to systematically, to systematically prevent any kind of achievement. I mean, you look at these black students, I hear what you're saying. I mean, you know, that is so prevalent. And that's, now you're talking about the educational institution. So think about the educational institution. That's just one institution that exactly. we interface yep. with, right? That is structurally designed so that black children will not achieve. And then, you know, you wonder, and you look at the racial wealth gap. You look at all of the manifestations of what structural and institutional racism creates, the world that it creates. And then you talk about, why black people haven't done this, that, and the other, as if as if there's been some kind of where we've been on the racetrack at the same place and starting from the same place. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the statistics that I have, and this was just a couple of years ago, so it's outdated now and it's worse, but the average wealth of a white family in America about 3 years ago was $144,000. And the average wealth of a black family is 11. 144,000 average, 11. And blacks are going towards zero, and they're predicting that it's going to get to zero by 2015. Yeah. I'm sorry, that is going. No, I forget what year, but that is going to go to zero. Now I don't even know what zero looks like, zero wealth looks like, but because of the coronavirus and what is happening now, it's moving it quicker down that road. And so they, what was said at that time, when it was 142,000 average wealth of a white family, 11,000 average of a black family, that it would take, if white folks didn't gain any more wealth, just stayed where they are, it would take 228 years for black wealth to catch up to white wealth in this country. 228 years, if it stayed steady. That's the reality of this country. There are different worlds going on here.
I like, do you want to do a generosity practice, everyone? Michael Eric Dyson recommends personal reparations.
Personal reparations.
Just start giving money to people know.
That's
to black people
That's right.
You know, give away that money that the feds just gave to everybody if you don't need it. Or question your need. Maybe you need it for something that you want, but maybe you don't really need it.
It goes to the question, what's enough, right?
Yeah,
what's enough? I mean, the economic, we looking at the violence in the street of, you know, the killing of George Floyd and all the other black folks that we've seen being murdered. that is, there's also economic violence. The economic violence against the black community is astounding. And that is something that, as you just said, you know, resources have got to move. 228 years is not going to happen. What is going to change this? Underneath it all, even, I mean, there's other people that Toni Morrison talks about that. It's not about race. It's not even about race. It's all about capital. It's all about money. I mean, wasn't it all about Africans being treated and slavery, enslavement? It was all about capital. And that that underlying, so we can't, that's why when I have my conversations, I'm having conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, and spirit. Because, right, isn't land one of the things that we use as a determinant of wealth in this country? And when black people's land has been taken in the 1920s, black folks accumulatively had about 18 million acres of land, of farm. I'm talking about, you know, the 40 acres and a mule never happened, but they still were able to accumulate land, about 18 million acres of land aggregate. Today, 2 million. And losing 30,000 acres a year, every year, we're losing 30,000 acres from a systemic play that is a collusion between banks, private sector, USDA, the government. I mean, it is just a land, race, money, and spirit. That intersection right there is worth having a conversation about and worth looking at.
I remember that when I first learned to meditate with Galanka and sitting next to Sharon and Joseph and the others in this monastery, and then when I was with Neem Karoli Baba, he told us to love everyone and serve everyone, and when we meditated and I saw, oh, it's about seeing things as they are, opening your heart, recognizing you're interconnected with everyone, and, you know, generosity, baby, like true, deep, full generosity.
Right.
And I remember I had been involved in the anti-war work and a lot of civil rights work before I got there. And so I thought, wow, this is so great. Now everybody's going to get it, right? And when we go back, things will be different, because I had marched in the 60s and things didn't change very much. So, and then we got back and I realized, it doesn't seem like everybody heard this the way I heard it, you know? And I realized that, when we started out with saying, like, people have experience, but they don't get it. They don't learn from it. There is an isolation of, without there being an intention, except a systemic intention,
right?
Of that white people can go through this, their lives in this country without having to see what's going on. I mean, not this week for most people, but, you know, still some. But education is so important. And so all of what you have been saying, Conda, is like, I'm sure there are people listening who, you know, are just hearing it maybe for the first time.
For sure.
And now there are lots of ways now. This is a difference from, you know, from those years ago. There are, yeah. I heard that, you know, the top, not everybody learns from books. I know this now, even though I was a literature student, but something like the top 10 bestsellers right now are books on race. And there are some really wonderful ones, which we all our organizations are recommending. I've recently been, Jason Reynolds, you know who he is, Conda? He's a young guy from Brooklyn. He's African American. He was named as the, it's like a poet laureate for young people's of poetry and fiction, and he's written a lot of young people's stuff. And he just rewrote Ibram Kendi's book, the book originally written for grown-ups.
Right.
He rewrote it for young adults. So good. I'm recommending it to people because it's hard for people to absorb all of this. And he does it. The other thing I totally loved was Van Jones did this town hall with Sesame Street the other day. I'm not infantilizing all of you. I'm just saying that there was a lot to be learned there. It was really great. They had little kids from across the country ask the questions, you know, why? Like, you know, why? Why do people say that people with brown skin are different from me? Why? Or vice versa, if they were brown. And then, like, the way little kids always say, it isn't fair. You know?
But see, that's the thing that adults have known all along. That's what I'm saying. I go back to, you know, would you change places? You know that it's not fair. You know that there's a distinction. You know it. You say you don't know it, and you do know it.
Yeah.
And you have the privilege to, you know, to choose not to live direct impact, but you are receiving every day in every institution the benefit. And so it is a situation where education is critical. Yeah. There's no doubt education is critical.
As this happens, and, you know, and some of the things that you were just saying, Conda, giving some facts and figures, as that education happens, and I'm hearing it inside myself, some of these things you just mentioned, I had never heard before, right? The level of, you know, the way of the discrepancy between what a family, a black family and a white family, what's going on with losing land, you know, all of these these kinds of facts, this kind of education, and there's an overwhelm that starts to happen for people that are getting suddenly realizing, okay, the veil has dropped off and you're willing to look, which is what's happening. And there's an overwhelm. And, you know, part of the overwhelm is obviously fear, in fear of the COVID, fear of, you know, losing your work, and fear of what's happening in terms of the protests and so on, fear for your neighbors, fear for your community, which includes Black people. So there's a kind of overwhelm that happens. And that's why I started this whole thing off with the question about how do we find some resilience to be able to deal with this, you know, because if it gets too overwhelming, it shuts and people down.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, so, you know, it's fear. Honestly, the veil that is being moved is, people see it, the fear of unearned privilege. That it was just given to you as you walked into this, as you were born. It's, and even though, you know, you may have worked really hard for what you have, and you can say, I've earned every penny of it. No, you didn't. You just didn't. Because the plate is different. You were born on a different plate than I was born on. And so, yes, you've worked hard, and it's unearned privilege. And so what happens, I think, is that white fear is that is to think about being equal or having the kind of treatment that Black people have been treated. Whatever you do, you don't want that. And so there's the fear of losing and being and coming and being on the level of where Black people are, and fear of Black rage, of knowing that there's been a huge discrepancy for and terror. That's not, we haven't even talked about the terror on our bodies, on Black bodies, that has existed since 1619. There's so much there, and this overwhelm, you know, and the shutdown over overwhelm, it's like, yeah, it can be overwhelming. I get that. And allowing shutdown is, again, a privilege to shut down. And it also feels like a mechanism to keep the status quo, even the shame that comes up. You know, and what that does, I find that to also be a way of, let me, you know, shame comes up, so that now stops me from doing anything. Mm-hmm. Or fear comes up, that stops me from doing it. Whatever it is, you still stay in that quarter of the world that you live in. And so I just have to say that, you know, as a Black woman growing up in America, with a very beautiful, loving family, and a family that told me that I could do anything I want to do, that I was smart, that I was beautiful, that I was all these things. I was one of the lucky ones that came in through a family that, and my mother, who's on the other side now, who was just the most precious being, and instilled in us, you know, all of who we are. But that's not the story that Black children get. They get that they are less than, and that they don't have, and then it's reinforced by every system and all of that. And so, you know, the idea of being overwhelmed and not doing anything is, again, an out, as far as I'm concerned. And we have had to create a resiliency as Black people in America from the time I was born. Right? By all the things that my mother had to tell me and that my family had to instill in me, don't believe what they're telling you. Don't allow this. Don't allow that. This is who you really are. Okay. This is, you know, when I, and all the double living that I do still is true. I mean, you know, going into a store and I am fully aware every store that I go in, especially now, like when you bring your own bags, you know, like it's a good thing to bring your own bags in stores. Right. And I live that way. I try to live as green as possible. And I am fully aware in every store I go to when I have a bag that, who's, and I'm very deliberate to take things and put them so that anybody can always see what I'm doing. I live my life like that. Every time I go to the store, I live my life like that. So this is the thing. right? This is the thing. This is what it looks like in an everyday basis. And someone who has been given the gift of the gift that I have of my life, you know, it is still an everyday existence for me. And so those who have even less access than I do, it's unbelievable. Mm. And so when I think about that, I just think that, you know, as white people who feel the overwhelm, it's like, yeah, well, it's been pretty damn overwhelming over on this side for a long time. You know, it's like, buckle up. Buckle up.
Yeah. That's what you said to me at the end of that conversation we had a couple of weeks ago after we talked about living behind the veil, and the privilege of not knowing is gone. And you ended it by saying, stop the we don't know bullshit already. Okay.
Right, exactly. It's likely this white fragility that I hope you all are familiar with, the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Exactly. The white fragility is just something that, have you read that, Raghu?
No, I have not.
Okay. Assignment. Read it.
Okay. Robin DiAngelo. Everybody, we're going to have all that in the show notes, okay?
Right. Robin DiAngelo's book, Robin White DiAngelo. Fragility, is an important piece of work. There's a lot of important pieces of work. My Grandmother's Hands is another one by Resma. But what I can send you to is a website, ERE, Education for Racial Equity. Education for Racial Equity. Full disclosure, I am an advisor to the executive director and on the advisory board, and it's where Robin is doing her work through. It's where Resma is doing his work through. There's a lot of great work that's being done and workshops that you could take no matter where you are on the planet. And that's the kind of, and I just want to say one thing, and that is that this is a lifelong work. This is not, I've read a book. This is not, I have a black wife. This is not, none of that. This is a lifelong work that, like what we've been doing in tandem with our mindfulness work, and it's lifelong. And one thing leads to the other. And if you are someone who's concerned and staying in this concerned place, but not actually acting and educating yourself and letting go of resources and moving what you know you can do, then you're still a part of the problem.
Yeah.
Bottom line, you're part of the problem. And so that's really how it lands for me. I think that I would hope that the work that we're doing as mindfulness inspired people, community, that we're able to understand the depths of really what compassion is, that we're able to really understand what unity and what that oneness is, and that we're able to understand also the relative world that needs so much of us to do so much work to absolutely dismantle the structural and our personal level of bias, implicit bias and racism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just going to call it out, you know, all the good white people, that you are so good. And yes, you still are racist, because that is the water we drink. That is the air we breathe. And I know you hate that. I know you're probably going to say, I'm not going to listen to her podcast. She just called me a racist. That's it. And it takes a whole lifetime to purge it. So get started if you haven't.
Yeah.
You know,
at least one lifetime, I would
say. At least. Exactly. Let's talk about lifetimes, man. So, yeah. I, you know, it is what it is. And again, it's not your fault. We did not create it. Yes. We came into this world. Yeah. We did not create this. And yet you are responsible for dismantling it, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I want to underscore that it takes a lifetime. Is it, you know, I mean, really, I'll be an example. So I started out when I was like 19 or something, you know, had the shoe repair awakening. And then, you know, all this time, it's been so important to me in all the ways you can imagine. And And I want to add, in terms of those of you who are educators, we did a lot of work inside the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society, which is now, the board is now 50% or more, I forget, African American. And we've worked a lot around developing ways that can bring the contemplative into helping educate better students of color. And there's fabulous webinars on that website led by people of color. So I encourage you to go to contemplativemind.org if you're an educator, yes, or just interested. But also I just wanted to say, so I've been like, that was 10 or 15 years of my life doing that one. And yet, there's still, you know, when I read White Fragility, there were parts of it that, you know, I would have emphasized a little something more than less. But when I read the statistics around leadership, the statistics around who controls all these different systems in our lives, including, you know, of course, education, of course, healthcare, but entertainment, the whole range, that they're all like, you know, 95% led by white people, mostly white men, the government, you know, and everything. Yeah. But there was something about reading that, and I realized, oh, all these years I've been engaged in work for equity and inclusion. Although it happened kind of anyhow, but I had not really paid enough attention to leadership. It's not just important to have X number of African-American people in your organization or whatever you're doing. Leadership, you know,
that's power. You're talking about power, Mirabai.
Yes.
That's where equity comes in. People, but people talk about this DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yeah.
What people are doing is this diversity thing, like, oh, let me add some people of color here or women here or whatever, right? And they still have no power. They're not in power positions. Equity, that is what equity is. Equity is power sharing. And power does not concede power very easily. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What has to happen is power sharing in every sector, all across the board. It has to be power share. And that is where equity is. And that's when you mean talk about leadership. Because you can sprinkle, you know, people of color in all kinds of positions, but are they the chair of your board? Are they part of your board? Are they the ones with the CEOs? Are they in the C-suite? Are they in leadership? Are they making the decisions? Yes. Are they the decision makers?
Yes.
And so that is what equity is all about. So if equity is not the game that we're playing, then the rest of it is just brainwashing. Really.
Yeah. Look at us, though. Obama president, right? And then suddenly the antithesis of a human being becomes president.
I'm going to tell you, if Donald Trump was a black man, oh my God.
I have often thought that. Oh my God.
We had to have the pristine, beautiful, handsome, most perfect black man to be the president.
And we found him.
Right? Yeah. He had to be all of that to be president. The bar for white men is so low.
It's unbelievable.
Just
unbelievable. But look at,
oh my God.
But the karma, though, there's a collective karma with this stands out.
He's just a part of the psyche he's representative of who we are, of what America is on, whether he doesn't represent you, he doesn't represent, but he is representing, look at this, look at America, look at America.
But I do think things are changing a little bit.
I didn't think
this 10 days ago, but
I'm thrilled at what's happening. I want those people to stay out in the streets forever. Thrilled at what's happening right
they
now.
Might, because
eventually wane, but then what's underneath that? What structures are going to be put in place.
Yeah,
what structures?
Yeah.
We have to restructure.
Absolutely.
And so that's what's really an important step. But I believe in direct action is absolutely, I mean, there's a lot of impact they've already had. I never thought I'd see this. And that when I look at the groups of people, these are young white kids. These are black kids.
Yep.
These are black. They are these young people, not kids, sorry. Those people, but these young people are making me feel hopeful about the generations that are behind us that might actually dismantle what has been, you know, the biggest, most harmful institution in America, which is the institution of racism.
Yeah.
And its pervasiveness throughout everything. And the anti-blackness that has we have been defined by, this country has been defined by. And so I know that, you know, it's hard to hear these things, and it's important for us to hear and talk about it. And to and folks who are connected to the Be Here Now Network, who are people who are connected to their hearts. I'm assuming, I'm just going to make a wonderful assumption that we're connected to our heart. Let the heart break, happen. Let it break. It needs to crack wide open and break.
Yes.
It needs to break. Because once it's broken, then as long as you keep hiding it from breaking, you're going to continue to perpetuate what we're seeing. So allow it to break.
And as Leonard Cohen said, the light then can come in.
The light can come in.
And I want to say, you know, we've been talking, we talked about my initial thing around resilience and so on, and we've talked about education and so on. We've talked about, you know, getting through that veil, you know, looking at our shadows, getting through the veil of, I don't know anything, you know, and so education is, of course, extremely important. But I have to say, just sitting here with you this last hour, has been a, I can feel where really listening, deep listening, and allowing that to take hold in a really deep place. And I think that that is just having the openness. And I do believe, yes, the people who are listening and to all of this, the different podcasts around consciousness on Be Here Now Network, and I do believe there is a big potential. You know, we've done this work for a long time, some of us, a shorter time, some of us, but we do have potential of open heart. And I think that deep listening is a big part of resilience here.
It is. Yeah. It's letting it in. I mean, we talk about mindfulness, which is about, right, like really accepting what is.
Yeah.
And what we have done is just accepted what is in our little corner. And block the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we're at the end of our chat here, and I want to really thank you, Conda and Mirabai. You know, this, as I say, this has been great for me, who is very common amongst white people, who has not really addressed this until, actually, thank God for our board pushing to address this and creating trainings and so on, and continuing to do that, because that's been personally gratifying to be able to look way deeper inside myself where I was not looking at. And what you said to me 2 weeks ago, that was it, Conda. Okay.
I don't even know what I said.
You said enough already is basically what you said.
Like,
enough.
Just cut the bullshit, right?
Yeah, right. That was it. I didn't need to hear anymore. And everybody out there, we will, you know, provide all of the links to the different books that we've been talking about, and websites, and of course, and Conda's going to be with us, and you'll be able to, you know, as I said, doing podcasts on Be Here Now Network. And
I also want to give resources for moving money.
Okay.
Move money to Black organizations,
yes,
to Black businesses, Black organizations. That needs to happen. We can't get away with this, you know, this internal, let me learn this stuff, and then I still got, I've accumulated all this accumulation, and it's still, that is not going to work.
Yeah, it's another
bypass. That has got to change. That's exactly right.
Another
bypass. You know, it's about moving your resources. Personal reparations and find somebody, find an organization, find, there's tons of good people doing good work. They're under-resourced. So.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
All right.
Again, thank you, everybody. We'll be back. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and share in these wonderful podcasts.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Khanda. It's wonderful.
Yeah, everybody, good talking to you. Good talking to both of you. Be well. All right.